by the king who lived there, a king of Media named William Randolph Hearst. I lived in a castle once upon a time. Not like Hearst Castle, but not unlike it either. I wound up there because I'd been renting a room from a man who turned out not to own the room in question. This was a complicated, awkward situation that left me with less than 48 hours to find a new place to live and filled me with a level of domestic anxiety that briefly eclipsed the uncertainty surrounding my budding career in home shopping. The year was 1990. I'd been at QVC for 3 whole months. Now I was on the verge of sleeping in my car, a poor calling card for an aspiring TV personality with dreams of working in prime time. So I turned to the classifieds and found an ad in the real estate section that was impossible to ignore. Owner of large country estate seeks discreet caretaker to oversee home and grounds, it read. Free rent, utilities included. It wasn't the free rent that caught my eye, or even the country estate. It was the quotation marks around caretaker. I understood what a caretaker does, but a caretaker in quotes? The secretary who took my call told me that her employer was seeking a discreet gentleman to occupy a mansion she owned on a 300-acre estate in Pennsylvania horse country. The mansion was called Georgia Farm. Really, I said, your boss wants someone to live in her mansion rent-free? Someone discreet. How about someone confused? I beg your pardon. I'm not sure I understand, I said. What exactly would I be doing there, aside from being discreet? Very little, she said. There's already a caretaker on the premises. He and his wife live in a separate building behind the barn. All that you have to do is occupy the main house and assist my employer as directed. I see, I said. So your employer is seeking companionship? The secretary giggled. Oh, no, she said. My employer has all the company she requires. You'll live alone at Georgia Farm. Alone, I said. And discreetly, she said. It was an utterly baffling phone call. But the secretary was nice. She sounded sane and seemed to like me. There and then, she arranged a time for an interview with her employer. Time is of the essence, she said. Tell me about it, I said. Marion Bolton Stroud was the socialite's name. Her friends called her Kippy. I met her a few hours later on the patio of the Marshalton Inn just outside Philadelphia. It was unusually warm for late October, but thanks to Joe, the bartender, my Heineken was unusually cold, just what I needed to process Kippy's story. Kippy told me that Georgia Farm had been her childhood home. According to her, it was idyllic, exquisite, a perfect place, and now she had inherited it. Well then, I said, why don't you just move in? I'd like to, she said, but my father's still there. We've never gotten along, not even a little. Who did you inherit the estate from? I asked. My father, Morris Stroud. He died last year. But your father, he's still in the house? Oh, yes. He walks the grounds at night. In the evenings, he sits in the great room by the fire. Kippy was in her mid-50s, well put together, and matter of fact, like her secretary, she seemed sane. And you want a caretaker who isn't a caretaker because... Kippy smiled patiently and addressed me as she would a child. The terms of my father's will are problematic. Georgia Farm is mine for as long as I want to live there. I inherited that right without inheriting the actual property. But if I don't move in within a year of his death, the estate goes to the Natural Lands Trust. They're itching to get their hands on it. And you don't want that to happen? No, she said. Not yet, anyway. But you're scared to move in because your father is still walking the grounds? Yes, she said. Something like that. And what is it you'd need me to do. If people from the trust come poking around, as they surely will, you will tell them I live there. When they ask you where I am, you will tell them I'm traveling. When they ask who you are, you will tell them that you are my lover. I nodded to Joe, who brought me another Heineken. Just to be clear, we're not going to be lovers, are we? Of course not, said Kippy. But feel free to invite them into the house. Show them where we sleep. The closet's filled with my old clothes. And your father? What should I tell him if he starts to ask questions? Handle the ghost of my father as you see fit, she told me. My hope is that he will eventually move on so that I can move in. Until he does, I won't return to Georgia Farm. But in the meantime, I don't wish to lose my right to live there. Even though you don't want to? Precisely, she said. Even though I don't want to. It was the strangest offer I'd ever received. But given the circumstances, it was an offer I couldn't refuse. And so, on Halloween, I moved into the mansion and started in on the strangest year of my life thus far. Strange, because Kippy turned out to be right. Georgia Farm really was haunted. Chapter 15, The Biscuit Bomb. Rodman looked constipated. The young private's expression was one of perpetual concentration, punctuated from time to time by a crooked smile that sometimes appeared apropos of nothing. His best friend, on the other hand, Private Levy, he was the undisputed life of the platoon. In the barracks and on the battlefield, too, he'd proven to be a consummate storyteller. In a matter of minutes, Private Levy's stories could transport his fellow soldiers out of whatever fresh hell they'd found themselves in. Indeed, his love of a good story would impact not only the lives of his fellow soldiers, it would transform the careers of Dennis Hopper, Robert Redford, Robert Duvall, Lee Marvin, William Shatner, Peter Falk, Elizabeth Montgomery, Jack Klugman, Carol Burnett. The list goes on. In fact, you could argue that The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, and many other classic TV shows would never have come to be if not for the extraordinary contribution this 19-year-old private made during the Second World War. But of the many stories that Private Levy would tell, the one that had the most impact unfolded beneath a palm tree on the bloody beach of a tiny island that most Americans couldn't have found on a map. Rodman was there on that day, December 18th, 1944, along with the rest of the platoon, and they were all hanging on Melvin Levy's every word. The boys of the 511th Parachute Infantry Regiment had spent a week fighting their way through the jungle, crawling through mud, slithering under barbed wire, and dying in record numbers. They'd lost 50% of their original complement. Yet, in the midst of the madness and mayhem, there stood Private Levy, holding court under a palm tree in tropical heat, weaving his spell and getting laughs in a country where laughter was no longer among the indigenous sounds. Rodman stood off to the side, smiling his crooked smile, looking vaguely constipated, and marveling at his friend's way with the story. At that very moment, high over their heads, and maybe a quarter mile to the south, a bombardier opened the doors of his DC-3. The payload left the plane cleanly and began to accelerate with the velocity one might associate with a 4,200-pound crate of K-rations, dry sausages, chocolate bars, and hard biscuits. The boys called those crates biscuit bombs, and with no supply lines to rely upon, they waited with great anticipation for those lifesavers to float down from the skies. Down at ground level, the men of the 511th were spellbound. Private Levy was working up to the climax of his tale. All of his stories had surprising twists, and the men had no idea where this one was headed. For a few brief moments, the exhausted soldiers forgot all about the enemy that surrounded them, as well as their gnawing hunger They had lost themselves in Private Levy's unpredictable narrative. Meanwhile, 400 feet above the beach, the parachute on one of the biscuit bombs failed to deploy. 100 feet after that, 2 tons of airborne grub reached terminal velocity. Private Levy had just arrived at his surprising, hysterical punchline. The men had dissolved in fits of laughter and broken into applause. Private Levy took a few steps toward Rodman to bum a cigarette. Rodman handed him the one he'd just lit and fished another out of his fatigues. 20 feet over their heads, the biscuit bomb was moving at roughly 200 miles an hour. A split second later, it landed directly on Private Levy. And that was that. The soldier was pulverized by the care package that had been meant to save his life. That man, Private Levy, transformed television, but not by forming a legendary studio, starting a talent agency, or pioneering a technical breakthrough. No, all he did was die a few feet in front of his best friend, in the most ironic manner you could imagine. That evening, Rodman, the only other Jewish kid in the platoon, wrote a eulogy for Private Levy. The next morning, he read that eulogy to the rest of the platoon in a crisp, well-modulated baritone. His words, carefully measured and delivered with great deliberation, articulated the underlying dread of living in a world beyond his understanding, a world where certainty was not for sale, a world where a giant box of biscuits could plummet out of the heavens and pulverize your best friend. War changes people, and Rodman was forever changed by the unlikely demise of Private Melvin Levy. He retained his crooked smile, his stilted delivery, and his vague look of chronic constipation. But from that moment on, the die was cast. Private Levy's surreal, gruesome passing had opened a door through which Rodman willingly walked. A door to another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. For that was the moment that a young private named Rodman Edward Serling first entered the Twilight Zone. You want to hear a ghost story? I don't blame you. As the narrator of cultural touchstones like Ghost Lab and Ghost Hunters, I'm partial to them myself. But the only ghost story I know to be true is the one I experienced firsthand at Georgia Farm. On my very first night in the mansion, I sat alone by a fire in the great room, where the severed heads of various animals loomed all around me. I was reading a mystery when, all of a sudden, the player piano sprang into action. The tune was Georgie Girl, a burst of sound that sent me rocketing out of the chair like a marionette yanked upward by some spastic puppeteer. I don't remember dropping my scotch on my way to the door. I just remember cleaning it up later, along with the shattered glass, while the player piano continued to roll on its own. That first night set the tone for the year that followed. Life at Georgia Farm was shot through with a strange feeling that shadowed my every move in the enormous home, which was not my own home. A fully furnished mansion with back stairways that led to hidden rooms and grand fireplaces big enough to stand in. A home built in 1740 and filled with the possessions of the last man who died there. A smoking jacket, velvet, a humidor, fully stocked. A gun rack with shotguns and rifles, antique. A liquor cabinet, also fully stocked, as well as that player piano with a mind of its own. That strange feeling was magnified by the strangeness of my new job. The graveyard shift at QVC had turned my days and nights upside down, leaving me in a permanent state of semi-consciousness. I'd leave for work at 1 in the morning, pausing on the way out to consider my reflection in an enormous mirror that hung in the vestibule. Suit and tie, freshly shaven. Did I look like a man who'd been singing opera for a living 1 month earlier? Did I look like a man about to discuss the timeless appeal of collectible dolls and fake diamonds? I didn't know, but I was starting to see my late-night interactions with narcoleptic shopaholics in a whole new light. There were so many people out there, eager to connect with a kindred spirit, even if that connection was going to cost them just 3 easy payments of $19.99. Georgia Farm was just 8 miles away from QVC's studio in Westchester, but the first few miles were country lanes. That made coming home from work a journey away from civilization. The driveway that led up to the main house was 1 mile long, at least, a gravel road that took its time winding up and around the old barn, went over a series of cattle guards, and ended at the top of the hill, where the house sat. It had an enormous porch with white pillars, a wide, sloping lawn that led down to a stone retaining wall, and beyond that, a lake stocked with perch and trout. Most mornings, I'd come home from work and sit on the porch, sipping a dead man's scotch. I'd watch the sunrise and go over the most meaningful interactions I'd had that day, conversations with disembodied voices who'd called in to talk to me while I was on the air. It was a lonely time, unsettled and unsettling. Sometimes, on the weekends, I'd have co-workers over. I encouraged them to bring friends, and word must have gotten around. One Saturday in early September, 200 people came by for an impromptu lawn party. Joe, the bartender, brought bushels of oysters and a couple of kegs, which he tapped on the veranda. I must have been an odd sight, dressed as I was in Mr. Stroud's smoking jacket, sitting on the porch with an antique shotgun across my lap. No one seemed to know who I was, and as a man hired for his discretion, I couldn't really answer their questions. I let my guests assume what they wanted, knowing that whoever they thought I might be wasn't me. Sometime after midnight, the player piano started in on an old song I'd learned from Fred King. People who pass me in pairs act like the sidewalks are theirs. Old friends seem to be total strangers to me, for I'm so alone in the crowd. That's how I felt at the end of that party, alone in the crowd. Then winter came to Georgia Farm, and I was alone for real. Before long, a blizzard dumped 2 feet of snow over Pennsylvania horse country. I was unable to get to the studio or anywhere else for the better part of a week. I lost phone service, but a generator in the barn kept the power on, for which I was most grateful. Without electricity, I would have lost my mind. Although, if you saw the videos I made during that period, you might assume I had lost it already. One evening, I set a camcorder on a tripod, trained the lens on the player piano, and hit record. The fireplace crackled in the background as I entered the frame, walking confidently, dressed in one of Mr. Stroud's many tuxedos, which fit surprisingly well. Nodding to my imaginary audience, I took a seat behind the ivories and flipped a switch under the keyboard. The tune was Mr. Bojangles, and as the keys began to move up and down on their own, I pretended to push them, pantomiming with all the verisimilitude I could muster. When the roll ended, I rose, bowed, and exited the frame. That night, I watched the footage and evaluated my performance. Did this handsome pianist look at all like Glenn Gould? Why, yes, I thought. Yes, he did. In the morning, I took a revolver down to the lake. Carefully, I set the camera in the crook of a tree, pointed it over the frozen surface, and hit record. The woods in the distance were dark and deep, but on this day, I had no promises to keep, only time to kill. That night, I watched the footage and evaluated my performance. Who was this dangerous drifter dressed in a cowboy hat and serape? This ominous hombre who wheeled around, drew his revolver with lightning speed, and took 6 imaginary enemies down in the blink of an eye. Did this gunslinger resemble Clint Eastwood? Why, yes, I thought. Yes, he did. With a few more days of stubble, there'd be no difference at all. The months went by. Spring came, and then summer and fall. I never did see the ghost of Morris Stroud. The player piano turned out not to have a mind of its own, only a timer that sometimes malfunctioned. Creaks and rattles I'd hear in the night all turned out to be just creaks and rattles. But again, Georgia Farm was haunted. Haunted by the man who stood in the vestibule every morning at 1 a.m., staring into that enormous mirror, thinking about who he was and what was happening to him. A friendly ghost, to be sure, but a ghost all the same. A kindly spirit who still looked a little like me. Chapter 16, The Men Behind Bars. Jimmy ran a very successful business for a very large company in a very competitive industry. After just 2 years, his revenues were in the tens of millions of dollars, and his customers were hopelessly addicted. The boss was pleased, very pleased. But on February 12, 1985, Nikki turned up dead, and things got complicated. Nikki wasn't the biggest earner on Jimmy's crew, but he was, in many ways, the most important. He wasn't just an earner. He was the heart and soul of Jimmy's operation, and his death left a big hole, a hole that had to be filled immediately. But who could fill it? Jimmy set out to find a replacement for that which had been irreplaceable. At the same time, halfway across the country, an Indiana farm boy wrestled with a very different kind of challenge. Tracy's dad had been arrested for murder and sentenced to life in prison. Clearly, the conviction was a bum rap. The state had spent millions of dollars prosecuting Tracy's dad, while the defense had spent less than $7,000 defending him. Plus, the wise guy, who'd allegedly hired the boy's dad to murder a judge, had been released in some kind of plea bargain. To top it all off, the judge who had condemned Tracy's father to a life behind bars had been one of the victim's pallbearers. The whole setup stunk. Tracy was determined to get his dad an appeal. Of course, that would require the services of a real lawyer, something that would cost real money. So, the 24-year-old farm boy from Indiana did what he felt he had to do. He assumed a new identity and went looking for the kind of job that paid the kind of money he needed. Tracy had no experience in this line of work, but he knew a few people who could possibly arrange a few introductions, and one of those people knew a guy who introduced him to another guy who arranged for a meeting with Jimmy. It was a pivotal moment for the kid from Indiana. There was no denying his nervousness when he walked into Jimmy's bar for a sit-down. "You know who I am?" Tracy nodded. "Yes, sir. You're Jimmy, though I'm not sure if that's what I should call you, sir." Jimmy smiled. The kid had an openness about him, an undeniable Midwestern likability that could be useful, assuming he possessed other necessary qualities that could make up for the loss of Nikki's unique set of talents. Jimmy and Tracy talked at length. Then Jimmy introduced him to his crew. It was important that everyone be comfortable with Nikki's potential replacement. Essential, in fact. Jimmy even asked Tracy to have a brief conversation with a few of his best customers, including a psychiatrist, to get a better sense of how he might cope with the pressures and challenges of Jimmy's operation. It was a leap of faith, sure, but decisions like that often are. So, Jimmy hired the kid from Indiana to fill Nikki's shoes, and to everyone's relief, Tracy fit right in. Not only did the work come naturally, the money was even better than he'd imagined. A lot better. Before long, he had enough to hire the best attorneys in the country and set them to work, reviewing the dubious case that had landed his dad in a maximum security prison. Tracy would spend many years and many millions of dollars trying to get his father a second chance. But it was all for naught. Even the brilliant Alan Dershowitz, with his Harvard Law School professorship and the team of legal eagles that he had assembled, failed to get an appeal through the courts. Maybe it was because it wasn't the first time that Tracy's father had been charged with murder. Nor was it the second time. The truth is, Tracy's dad really was a hitman, a natural-born killer. And even though the circumstances surrounding his final conviction were undeniably squishy, the totality of his life was not exactly consistent with that of a model citizen. That was why he was denied his appeal. That's why he died behind bars 22 years after his son walked into one to interview for the job that changed his career. It's worth noting, though, that although Tracy worked at Jimmy's bar every day, he kept his dad's personal drama to himself. He knew that Jimmy's customers didn't want to hear a sad story about some kid from Indiana whose dad had turned out to be a murderer. They just wanted to relax in a friendly place where they all knew one another. Tracy also knew that Jim Burrows had given him more than a chance to pour beer in America's favorite bar. He'd given him a chance to become America's favorite bartender, just as his predecessor, Nicky, had been. Nicky Colasanto, the actor who'd given us a lovable character named Coach. That's how Charles Void Harrelson wound up behind bars in a cold and lonely place where everybody knew his name. And that's how his son, Woodrow Tracy Harrelson, became Woody Boyd, a man who spent 8 years in a much friendlier joint, working behind the bar in a place called Cheers. To live outside the law, you must be honest. That is a direct quote from Bob Dylan, and it came to mind while I was sitting at the bar in Grumpy's writing the story you've just heard. Was Charles Harrelson an honest man? Was he honest with his fellow criminals? Was he honest with his son? With himself? The bartender at Grumpy's had no answers, but wanted me to know that Bob Dylan was his favorite artist of all time. An absolute genius, he said. Why don't you write a story about him? Did you know he won a Nobel Prize? I swallowed some anchor steam and nodded. I heard about that, I said. Maybe I will. I never did write that story, but if I had, I'd have called it The Big Lie, because Bob Dylan was not what you'd call a slave to the truth. It's true. Bob Dylan lied his way through countless press conferences. He swiped melodies, arrangements, and lyrics from friends and forebears alike. His own memoir contains multiple lines lifted from various sources, and his Nobel Prize lecture in 2017 contained 20 passages pilfered from the Sparks Notes summary of Moby Dick. Even the quote I've just attributed to him is another way of saying, honor among thieves. That concept was first discussed in Plato's Republic, then by Shakespeare and Henry IV, and then in every movie ever made about the mob and the importance of not being a rat. Which begs a bigger question. Why the hell would anyone ever believe anything Bob Dylan says? And that question reminds me of my good friend John Stewart. Long before fake news became a real problem for genuine journalists, there was a real show about genuine news with fake journalists, The Daily Show. On that show, Jon Stewart lampooned every single pretense of news production, the overly dramatic music, the movie trailer voiceovers, the ridiculous graphics, the desperate attempts by achingly earnest anchormen to make us believe they weren't reading someone else's words off a teleprompter. That was all perfect fodder for satire. But a funny thing happened to my friend, Jon Stewart. The less earnest he appeared to be, the more trusted he became. And the more trusted he became, the more seriously he was taken. It was fascinating to watch, especially when people disagreed with him. "Hey, folks," he said, "what's the problem here? I'm just a guy telling jokes." But now that everyone trusted him, no one believed him. Poor John. He simply couldn't have it both ways. Suddenly, millions of people were turning to The Daily Show for actual news. John Stewart was more trusted than every actual anchorman out there, and Comedy Central was more credible than Fox and CNN. Is it any wonder fake news became a real thing? Speaking of lies, let's assume for a moment that no one on television tells the truth, ever. Trust me on this one, it's not a stretch. One day, I appear on your TV screen and say, "Hi, I'm Mike Rowe, and I'm lying to you." Would that statement be true? It couldn't be, right? Because by definition, everyone on TV lies all of the time. But if I confess that I'm lying in a place where no one ever tells the truth, wouldn't that make my confession fundamentally honest? If so, would it not therefore be more accurate to say that the only way to be completely authentic in a place where everybody lies is to never tell the truth? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. But I take comfort in something my father used to say. A promise made is a debt unpaid. When it comes to trustworthiness, that strikes me as a sensible statement. But down here at Grumpy's, where I like to go after explaining how the universe works to my trillions of viewers, my ethics tend to be a bit more situational. So I'm going to have one more anchor steam and think seriously about the pros and cons of plagiarizing the next chapter and dedicating it to my good friend, Bob Dylan. Chapter 17, The Cherry Pie is to Die for Bob Dylan. Ted stands perfectly still in the Louisiana woods and looks for signs of prey. He loves to hunt, but today he'd rather be home. The heat is stifling, the rifle feels heavy in his hands, and there's no sign of game. Ted allows his mind to wander, and before long, he's thinking about the waitress in Dallas, the one he met 5 years ago, the one who got away. They'd met at the lunch counter at Marco's. He'd been a postal worker back then and had stopped in one afternoon for a quick bite. The waitress hadn't noticed him at first. She'd been writing something. "Must be mighty important," Ted said, "to make such a pretty face scrunch up like that." The waitress jumped at the sound of his voice. "Sorry, mister. I was someplace else. What can I get you?" She was a tiny thing, not even 5 feet tall. Her blonde hair was uncombed, and her eyes were wide and very blue. "I'd like a BLT," said Ted, "and a cup of coffee." "You got it, but save some room for dessert. The cherry pie is to die for." "Thanks," said Ted. "I'll do that." The waitress wrote up his order, passed it to the cook, and went back to her papers. "What are you working on?" Ted asked. "Oh, nothing," she said. "It's just a poem." "What's it about?" The waitress considered the postal worker. He had a warm smile and a trustworthy face. "It's about a nice boy who falls in love with the wrong girl." "Maybe you'd like to read it to me," said Ted. And that's what the waitress did. "You don't want to marry me, honey, though just to hear you ask me is sweet. If you did, you'd regret it tomorrow, for I'm only a girl of the street. Time was when I'd gladly have listened before I was tainted with shame. But it wouldn't be fair to you, honey. Men laugh when they mention my name. Back there on the farm in Nebraska, I might have said yes to you then, when I thought the world was a playground, just teeming with Santa Claus men. But I left the old home for the city to play in its mad, dirty whirl, never knowing how little of pity it holds for a slip of a girl." The waitress stopped reading. "That's all I got," she said. "What do you think?" "Well," said Ted, "I'm hoping for a happy ending." The waitress offered a sad little smile. "Aren't we all, mister? Aren't we all?" 5 years have gone by, and Ted hears a sound that yanks him back to the hunt. Something is approaching in the distance, something large. Ted clicks off the safety of his rifle and waits to see what might appear in the clearing. He understands the stakes. He understands the danger. But his thoughts are still on the waitress. He recalls their second meeting. She was still behind the counter at Marco's when he walked into the joint, still writing, still lovely, her pretty face still scrunched up in concentration. "You were right," said Ted. "The cherry pie was to die for." Once again, the waitress jumped at the sound of his voice. "You gotta quit sneaking up on me, mister." Ted laughed. "Sorry about that. I thought you saw me come in." The waitress poured him some coffee. "How's the poem coming?" he asked. "Chipping away at it." She picked up where she'd left off, reading quietly so that the other customers couldn't hear. Her lips were very close to Ted's ear. "I soon got a job in the chorus, with nothing but looks and a form. I had a new man every evening. My kisses were thrilling and warm. Then I fell for the line of a junker, a slim devotee of hop. And those dreams in the juice of a poppy had got me before I could stop. But I didn't care while he loved me. Just to lie in his arms was delight. But his ardor grew cold, and he left me in a Chinatown hop joint one night." The waitress paused and brushed away a tear. Ted wanted to take her hand. He wanted to comfort her. He wanted to tell her that people can change, even a girl from the street. But the waitress wasn't quite finished. "Don't spring that old gag of reforming. A girl hardly ever goes back. Too many are eager and waiting to guide her feet off of the track. A man can break every commandment, and the world will still lend him a hand. Yet a girl that has loved, but unwisely, is an outcast all over the land." Ted could take no more. He'd never seen so much sadness in such a pretty face. "Listen to me," he said. "One day, a man is going to walk through those doors and sweep you off your feet. A good man. A man who doesn't care about your past. And from that moment on, your life will never be the same." "Do you really think so?" she asked. Ted looked earnestly into her wide blue eyes and said, "Maybe he already has." For the next 3 months, the postal worker stopped by every day for a quick bite with some poetry on the side. And for a while there, it looked like the waitress might write him into her story. But one day, she was gone. Her replacement, Edna, was a 65-year-old grandmother with a snaggletooth. It was Edna who gave poor Ted the bad news. "Don't know where she went," said Edna. "Said she wouldn't be back. Said she found the love of her life. Now what can I get you?" Ted was stunned. He swallowed hard and looked blankly down at the menu. But the menu had nothing he wanted. Edna poured him some coffee. "Try the cherry pie," she said. "It's to die for." Even now, 5 years later, hidden in the Louisiana woods, Ted can remember the heartbreak he felt that day. Even as his prey draws ever closer, even as his fellow hunters raise their rifles alongside his, even as the stolen Ford crests the hill on Highway 154 and slows down at the intersection of the clearing, even as he and the rest of the posse open fire with Tommy guns from the woods on the side of the road. When the shooting finally stops, 136 rounds of hot lead have perforated the stolen Ford. Many of those bullets have also perforated the man behind the wheel. Then the smoke clears, and Ted slowly approaches what's left of the driver. It's him, all right. Justice has finally caught up with the bank robber who's killed 12 cops in cold blood. Now, Ted considers the passenger. She's a tiny thing, a slip of a girl, not even 5 feet tall. Her blonde hair is uncombed. Her dead eyes are wide open and very blue. He hangs his head, closes his own eyes, and recalls the final stanza from the poem she'd read him 5 years ago. "You see how it is, don't you, honey? I'd marry you now if I could. I'd go with you back to the country, but I know it won't do any good. For I'm only a poor branded woman, and I can't get away from the past. Goodbye, and God bless you for asking. but I'll stick it out now, till the last. You might not have heard of Ted Hinton, the postal worker turned deputy sheriff who was hired to hunt down the notorious bank robber. You might not remember a poem called The Street Girl, but you've probably heard of the waitress who wrote it, the woman who got away, until she didn't. An aspiring poet whose only appearance in print was in the headlines on the most wanted posters, a famous outlaw named Bonnie Parker. What if Bonnie had taken a flyer on Ted? She didn't know him from Adam, and yet there was something between them. Ted had felt it. Had Bonnie felt it too? He might have kept on working for the post office. She might have kept on being a waitress or become a published poet. Together, they might have been happy, as I was when a woman named Joan took a flyer on me. It was September 1991. I had been fired from QVC a few months earlier, justifiably. Rehired, inexplicably. Then banished, sent back to the graveyard shift for my sins. Permanently. Then, a nasty flu had gone around, and most of the prime-time hosts had gone home, where they'd been now for several days, puking their guts up. I'd been called in to fill in for the stricken, and I was halfway through a riveting hour called Ideas to Make Your Life Easier, when Joan walked into the studio. Rivers was the Joan in question, a mythical figure who'd come up the hard way in the business, enduring ups and downs that would have crushed lesser women. She was a genius, a legend, a rebel. She was the Bonnie Parker of comedy. I'd never met her, but I knew who she was, and it was unthinkable to me that my bosses would turn her loose on QVC's G-rated audience. Stranger still, that they would allow her to share the same stage with me. And yet, there she was. Rivers was there to promote her line of clothing and jewelry. She had been scheduled to appear that morning with a real, reputable host. But, on her way to the green room, she had stopped to watch as I sang a tune from Mac and Mabel, hoping to boost the sales of a portable karaoke machine. When I was done, she pulled something out of her giant purse, walked onto the set, and began asking questions right there on live television. "Oh my God," she said, "where did you get that tie?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Your tie," she said. "It's awful. Did you steal it from a Lutheran?"
"I made it myself," I said, "on a loom in my attic."
"It's hideous, truly. And that suit, you look like an unmade bed."
"Thanks," I said. "It helps me sleep on the job. You look radiant, though, if I may be so bold."
"Look a little closer. One more facelift, and I'll have a goatee."
It took me a second, but the image sunk in. I may have chortled. I may have even guffawed. If I'd been wearing dentures, I might have spat them across the room.
"You seem like a nice young man. It's a shame you don't have any taste. Is there a woman in your life?"
"Several," I replied, "but none that compete with your years of experience." Joan laughed. She gave me the finger. Then she presented me with a tie-button tie, a fancy piece of silk with a buttonhole in the back that allowed a gentleman to affix the tie to the button on his shirt in a way that, in her words, was simply to die for. "It won't swing into your spaghetti sauce the next time you take one of your special ladies out for a big night at the Olive Garden," she said. Rivers told me all about the various trinkets and garments she'd come on to sell, including a simulated diamond set in 14-karat gold that she suggested would be perfect for any of the women in my life. "Remember, ladies, fake jewelry doesn't have to make you look like a slut, even if you are one." She described one stretch jersey as a pretty little thing with a nice, comfortable lining that won't get stuck in your ass crack. She made me laugh, both because she was funny and because I imagined my bosses recoiling in horror. Joan wasn't off script. She was unscriptable. To me, that made her heroic. I didn't see her again for a year and a half. By then, she had become a fixture at QVC, well on her way to selling $1 billion worth of stuff. Really, a billion. I, on the other hand, I was still working the graveyard shift, still hawking products that appeared to have been sourced from the midway of some condemned carnival. Then, I caught a break. QVC and CBS agreed to co-produce a pilot around Joan, tentatively called Can We Shop? Under the terms of the deal, Joan could select any QVC host to be her second banana, and she chose me. I can't express how profoundly surprising that decision was. To me, to my fellow QVC hosts, and most of all, to those who had consigned me to the graveyard shift. But Rivers insisted. The next thing I knew, I was sitting next to her on a soundstage in New York City, doing my very best Ed McMahon impression. Go figure. In television, as in real life, you don't always know the significance of a thing when it happens. This was different. I knew exactly what it meant. Appearing on CBS with Joan Rivers was the first thing I'd done that looked halfway legitimate. I left QVC soon after that, of my own volition. I never saw Rivers again. Not in person, anyway. Like the rest of the world, I saw her on the red carpet and watched her shenanigans here and there. How could I not? Icons have a way of being everywhere at once. I watched a piece of work, the fine documentary about her. I wanted to call her afterward and tell her how brave she'd been to be that forthcoming. I still wish I had, but I'll settle for my memories of a holiday party at her Fifth Avenue penthouse. It was a black tie affair, but I wore one of her tie-button ties. It amused her to no end. I brought her some cookies, too. My mom, upon learning that I would be visiting the home of a bona fide celebrity, was afraid I would arrive empty-handed, or worse, with a six-pack of Rolling Rock under my arm. She made a tin of chocolate chip cookies and told me to give them to Mrs. Rivers with her compliments, which I did. I don't know if Joan actually ate them, but she accepted them with grace and put them on the mantel next to her menorah. Chapter 18, A Manly Man, A Gold Medal, and A Really Big C. Long before he won the gold medal that ended up on his mantle, the manly man stood in the sand at the tip of Balboa Peninsula, smoking a cigarette, staring at the biggest waves he'd ever seen. God Almighty, he said, that is a really big sea. The Olympic champion standing next to him smiled and nodded. Monstrous breakers, blown to towering heights by an offshore breeze, were being forced together at the last moment by a series of jetties that guarded Newport Harbor. Local surfers called it the wedge. Sensible people called it a death trap. Wally O'Connor called it a challenge. You're right, said Wally. This is a very big sea. Isn't it fantastic? The manly man felt the adrenaline course through his body. This was the way he felt every week on the gridiron, moments before the bone-jarring impact at the line of scrimmage would determine who remained standing and who got knocked to the ground. He was addicted to the feeling, which is why he was drawn to this dangerous new fad that Wally had come up with. I'll take the first pass, said Wally. Watch and learn. The manly man stepped back into the crowd, lit another camel, and watched Wally O'Connor glide through the water. It was easy to see why he'd won gold in Paris. He ducked under one wave and then another, swimming hard against the riptide with long, powerful strokes. 100 yards out, the water was only 4 feet deep, but the waves were at least 8 feet in height. Treacherous, to say the least. Wally waited for the wave he wanted, dove into its base, pushed hard off the shallow bottom, and burst out of the crest. Then he began to fly. At least, that's how it looked to everyone who was watching. Partially embedded in the curl of the surge, Wally eased himself into the pipeline while extending one hand in a stop gesture. His upturned palm, carved into the great rumbling wall of water, while his other arm remained tucked behind him. With white foam shooting off his chest and green water breaking over his head, Wally flew toward the shore like Superman. No one had ever seen anything like it, surfing without a board. As the mighty wave began to crash in around him, Wally stroked hard, staying just in front of the thunderous crash that sent him flying toward the beach like a human missile in a sea of foam, skimming across the surface before sliding gracefully onto the sand, where the locals greeted him with wild applause. Wally stood, took a modest bow, and turned to the manly man, who had yet to win a gold medal. "You're up, champion. Ready?" The big man nodded. "I am." A simple answer to a simple question that wound up changing the course of his life. The manly man confronted the big sea with manly confidence, imitating everything he'd seen Wally do. He swam hard against the riptide for 100 yards. He waited for a wave as big as Wally's had been. When it came, he dove into its base, pushed off the shallow bottom, and burst out of the white water, at which point he began to fly, just like Wally. But here's the thing. If you're going to go toe-to-toe with the big sea, you'll need more than manly confidence. You'll need perfect timing. And when the wall of water began to fall apart all around him, the manly man was out of position. Thus, his manly body was propelled with great velocity not toward the beach, but rather straight toward the shallow bottom. Over the crashing roar of the surf, over the muted sound of his own screams, he heard the sounds of his future vanishing before him. The snap of his collarbone, the crack of his arm, the crunch of his shoulder as it popped out of its socket. Those were the sounds of a football scholarship coming to an end, along with his college education at USC and the law degree he had hoped to graduate with. All of it gone, taken away by the really big C. In the back of the ambulance, broken and lucky to still be alive, the manly man lit another Camel. Did he foresee that the only job he'd be able to find in the course of that year would be in the props department at 20th Century Fox? Did he foresee that schlepping those props back and forth between sets would lead to an audition, which would ultimately require him to change his name to something more masculine? Probably not. But one thing is for sure. The manly man could have never imagined the press conference he would hold in his living room 35 years later, the one conducted just 4 days after his surgery. There, in his Encino home, the manly man, now with his manly name, but still no gold medal, gave an Oscar-worthy performance, smiling bravely through unspeakable pain and talking with great confidence to the Hollywood press. He assured the reporters who'd gathered there that he was ready to get back in the saddle. He didn't show them the giant purple scar around his left side. He didn't discuss the lung that had just been removed, or the 4 ribs that he was now missing. He didn't mention the sutures that kept breaking open every time he coughed, or the bucket of phlegm and sputum upstairs by his bed. As for the disease itself, he didn't even mention it by name. "I've licked the big C before," he told reporters, "and I'll lick it again. Trust me, fellas, when I go out, it'll be on both feet." The reporters were delighted. No one had called it the big C before. No one had ever dismissed it as nothing more than a mere nuisance. Surely, if anyone could beat the disease, it would be the manly man who reduced it to a nickname. And sure enough, he did, completing 2 dozen feature films over the course of the next 12 years, including the one that finally won him an Oscar. But here's the thing. If you're going to go toe-to-toe with the really big C, you'll need more than manly confidence. You'll need to stop smoking. Unfortunately for the manly man, that was simply too much to ask. And so, the man who had beaten the Japanese, the Mexicans, the Nazis, the Viet Cong, the Mongols, and too many Indians to count, in too many Westerns to recall, was ultimately vanquished by a deadly horde of unfiltered camels. 5 packs a day, over the course of 4 decades, and then some. In the end, the man who'd shot Liberty Valance didn't possess the true grit to quit smoking. Today, there's a cancer foundation that bears his manly name, along with a park in Newport Beach, an airport in Orange County, and the credits of more than 200 films. It's the same name that's on the back of the gold medal he finally did get in the hospital 1 month before he died in 1979. A congressional gold medal embossed with the name that we all know today, thanks to the manly man's run-in with a really big C, a run-in that changed his life, and the really big C that ended it. It was a shame, but a pretty good run, all in all, for the kid who was born Marion Morrison and died a manly man named John Wayne. I was in Seattle filming the first round of After the Catch, a talk show that takes place in a bar. The setup was simple. Captains and crew from Deadliest Catch gathered to chatter, confer, sometimes confabulate. I was the moderator. Picture a pre-hashtag Charlie Rose, but with cigarettes and whiskey. We were recording the show in real time, or something close to it, as though it were a live production. Producers, directors, and cameramen were milling about, positioning cameras around a big table and setting up all kinds of lights. But I got the sense that nobody actually knew what was going to happen once shooting began, and that turned out to be the case. The captains sat down at the table. They didn't know what was happening either. I wouldn't have called them nervous. These were manly men, too, after all. Let's call them fidgety and full of questions about how the day would unfold. I had no answers to give them. Unlike ship's captains, I prefer states of confusion. I think they make for good television, and I said as much. I also suggested that, given the setting, there were any number of remedies on hand that would take the edge off. Only one of the captains seemed completely at ease, Phil Harris, who had arrived at the last minute and done so in style, aboard a brand new Harley Davidson. He'd walked into the bar with a gargantuan smile on his face and said hello to each of the captains in turn before turning to me. "Hey, Phil," I said, "how's it going?" "I got nothing to say to you, Mike, until you ride my hog." Resistance was futile. When Phil wanted something done, it got done, and his enthusiasm for whatever it was that grabbed his attention was contagious. At sea, he focused on catching crab. At home, he focused on his boys, Josh and Jake. At the moment, he was focused on his new motorcycle, something that gave him so much joy, he just had to share it with me. And he did. He insisted upon it. By the time I rode back into the parking lot, the other captains were in very good spirits. Mind you, Phil wasn't perfect. He had a temper. He rode fast and drove fast. Like John Wayne, he smoked like a chimney. Needless to say, he cursed like the sea dog he was. He'd been the captain of his boat, the Cornelia Marie, for close to 2 decades, and he liked to do things his way. But his way left a lot of room for other people. Once I ran into Phil in Las Vegas. I was speaking at the Con Expo convention, and Phil happened to be there manning a booth for a pulley company. During a break, I wandered over and watched him talk to his fans. There were many of them, Deadliest Catch fans who were delighted to see Phil in person. They wanted autographs, handshakes, a word or two with their favorite captain. The line grew and grew, but Phil had all the patience in the world for them. Standing behind a display, unobserved, I saw him focus completely on the person in front of him.